You're listening to Innovation for Alpha, where we explore everything at the intersection of healthcare innovation and finance. Through our discussions and interviews, we keep you informed and educated about healthcare innovations, next-level venture investing, and everything involving the combination of the two.
Hi, everybody. This is Tobin Arthur, your host for Innovation for Alpha, and I am joined today by a very special guest. And Dr. Ian Sarenbach is an advisor to AngelMD. He's recently retired from a storied career in vascular surgery and all kinds of things related to that. So I'm really excited, Dr. Sarenbach, to have you on the show today and just explore your background. We've had a conversation once where I got a chance to hear some of it. And so I'm looking forward to sharing that with our audience. So welcome.
Thank you very much. And it's really a privilege and a pleasure to share my story, which is a little different, I think, to the run of the mill in the US. So as you can hear, I speak funny and have done so for the last 70 years, I might add. But that aside, I was born and grew up in South Africa, went to prep and high school, and the oldest all-boys school in South Africa, The South African College School called SACS, S-A-C-S, graduated there in the late 60s. And we don't go to college. So I went to med school literally when I just turned 17, which is sort of scary to contemplate in this day and age, but so be it. Our curriculum is actually 6 years with a obligatory here of internship, which is doesn't count to your specialization, but is a requirement for licensure. So I did my 6 years plus one as an intern. And during my intern year, I did 6 months of internal medicine, 6 months of surgery as an intern, and really was inspired by one of my sort of heroes, Dr. Andre Swanepoel, whose medical firm I was an intern on for 6 months in internal medicine. Wonderful man, great mentor and role model, and really a cardiologist before cardiology became a really sort of specialty service, if you like. And that really inspired me to really focus on doing cardiology. At the time, which was now in the mid to late 70s, there was compulsory national service in South Africa, which is a fancy way of saying you're going to the army. some people sort of ducked out of South Africa. I sort of felt, well, I have an obligation for a year. So in I go in 1977, January, to the army to find out 9 months later that they'd made it 2 years retroactive to my intake. So I had the misfortune of spending 2 years in the South African Defense Force. I might add just parenthetically, fighting for a cause that I didn't believe in, but be that as it may, I did get some pretty good medical experience during that time and then transitioned to doing internal medicine. As I was completing internal medicine, I had already decided I was going to do cardiology, but was offered a pretty prestigious scholarship to get further a doctorate degree. And in South Africa, we get two bachelor degrees, a Bachelor of Medicine, Bachelor of Surgery. So we have, our sort of initials are MB, Bachelor of Medicine, CHB, Bachelor of Surgery. So that's our equivalent to the MD degree.
Okay.
If you do a doctorate and it's more sort of clinically focused, you do there an MD. If you're doing more basic stuff, it's a PhD. So I did my MD in aortic regurgitation, so valve disease, at a time where, it was rampant in the third world, of course, and we got lots of experience in that field, but it really wasn't a focus in the United States. So I spent 2 years gathering all my data for my MD thesis and then transitioned to complete my clinical cardiology fellowship in the mid-80s. It was really during my time doing my MD thesis work that my wife and I made the tough decision, I think, to leave our country for reasons that we don't have to go into, but are pretty obvious. We had two young kids. We didn't see a real future there. We had no idea how things would pan out. And they were, it was almost a miracle, as you know, how there was a peaceful transition to black majority rule in the sort of early 90s. But nobody was predicting that, certainly in the early 80s. So we made the decision and packed up and came to the U.S. in 1986. I had a one-year position at Yale University as a research associate. So I'd finished my training, per se, and ended up spending 2 years there working in a research lab of Mike Ezekiewicz, who is an ex-South African close friend and really gave me this opportunity, which in retrospect was amazing. He had gotten a grant to evaluate and focus on the role of platelets in vascular balloon injury, which was balloon angioplasty, which was just sort of ramping up, having, you know, undergone sort of trial and error in the late 70s, early 80s. So we were looking scientifically at how one might prevent the re-narrowing of the artery after ballooning, so-called restenosis. And that sort of really was a wonderful experience and really sort of cemented my interest in the whole issue of vascular injury and repair throughout my career. And I then, after 2 years, we moved to the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, where I continued my research work and was fortunate enough in the early 90s to get a big NIH grant as one of four sort of what were called requests permission to do this work in the country. So that was pretty special. And at the time was interested in the whole role of thrombin inhibition, which is a potent promoter of thrombosis. And we did a lot of work with both thrombin inhibition and the sort of upstream pathway inhibition of thrombin during that, the 90s, really. And it became clear that, you know, things were moving more molecular. And so from a sort of a bigger rabbit animal model, we transitioned to a mouse model and then started studying the whole role of inflammation in vascular injury and repair. And really, it was a wonderful experience with the training of a whole host of interventional cardiology fellows in my lab. And I have to say that it was really one of the highlights of my career, mentoring and providing, you know, new knowledge, which is really what research is, in the hope that one would help patients ultimately. And I think we contributed pretty significantly to that endeavor. In parallel with that, you know, I had a real job doing clinical medicine, which I loved, and just have to have a shout out to my mentors and colleagues back in Cape Town, South Africa, at the cardiac clinic. I've said this more than 1,000 times in the last 40 years. I am just so grateful for the amazing, amazing clinical training I had. I wouldn't swap it out for anything. And it was tough, because these guys were really tough on you. They'd probably be in jail if they tried the tactics they did today. But be that as it may, I am eternally grateful for the wonderful, wonderful clinical training both I and many others got around the time. You know, the late 70s, early 80s was just magical training at the cardiac clinic in Cape Town. So that's just, you know, something that I feel very fortunate and proud of, being a member of the cardiac clinic in Cape Town.
Did you know, by the way, at the time that you were going into such a great program, or was that
you discovered it? Well, you know, I was born and grew up in Cape Town. You know, so this was Groot Schuur Hospital, which is the hospital where the first heart transplant was done. Oh. And so they had just from the 50s through the 70s, early 80s, just an absolute powerhouse of cardiology in addition to cardiac surgery. So it was amazing. And, you know, not that it wasn't good after that, but I think those were the heydays, that's for sure. So then I, you know, and at UVA, as I say, had really two jobs. Well, I don't even call them jobs, but they were two professional callings. One was my research lab, which was by today's standards called a translational research lab. So it's not basic science. It's not clinical. It's somewhere in between. And at the time, you know, I wasn't a basic scientist, but I realized that it was important to collaborate with basic scientists at a time where it was really an us versus them mentality. So these guys were very smart, very committed, very hardworking, but they didn't really have an entree to testing concepts and mechanisms, you know, in living organisms. So, you know, as they say in Latin, in vivo veritas, which means, you know, you've got to really substantiate something in a living being rather than in a, you know, an experimental situation. So I was really fortunate and privileged to work with a bunch of incredibly talented basic scientists at UVA, and that added to the just the marvelous experience that I had. And as I say, that was sort of lane one. Lane two was clinical medicine. Lane three was really education. But lane two was also great because, you know, as I reflect back on my career, I have to say that I did cardiology from really the late 70s through to 2021. So that's 50 years. No, 40 years. Let me get my math right. Yeah. 40. But in that time, cardiology underwent an explosive metamorphosis from the days where somebody came with a heart attack, you controlled their pain, you put them to bed, and you hope for the best, to what happens today where you saving heart muscle, saving lives, and transforming care in a way that is miraculous in many ways. And that was just one piece of it. And then in the last decade plus, the whole explosion of treating valvular heart disease is just absolutely amazing. And it doesn't come with just, oh, well, there's this interesting technology and let's give it a go. It's been systematic randomized clinical trial work by many colleagues that I hold in very high esteem, and I've thankfully been part of a fair amount of that, and really ultimately with the North Star being what is in the best interest of patient care. And I think as a physician and some advice for colleagues, many of whom, you know, are working incredibly hard and at times under tough sort of circumstance. And as you know, the burnout rate in cardiology is pretty high. Yep. And it's really shameful because here are very talented, highly educated people just calling it quits at a time when, you know, their expertise is so much needed. And you know, my hope is that we can get beyond that, because I think medicine is incredibly exciting at the moment. I think one should honestly not view it as a job, because that's not what it should be. Mm-hmm. And yet there are challenges, and I think one has to try and meet those challenges. You know, if I take myself as an example, I was fortunate enough to get up every day and want to go to work. And that's a blessing, because I don't think that applies to that many people. But I think staying positive, seeing the bright side of things, and ultimately, as a physician, being able to say with confidence that every single day you interact with patients, you do good for people. Mm-hmm. You know, some people make a lot of money for others, and some people inspire others through their art or other areas of expertise. But as a physician, I think it's just incredibly special to be able to say, you know, I have really in a major way impacted this person's life, be it by controlling their blood pressure, controlling their cholesterol, controlling their diabetes or any other chronic illness, and taking a real interest in doing that. So,
well, that's so perfectly said, by the way. I'll just jump in real quick on that. You know, it happens to be, we're recording this on World Physician Day. So I think that's a neat perspective, because I don't think most people understand that physicians, I think by and large, have that perspective. You know, they get up every day to help patients. And yes, it's a great career and there's lots of side benefits and things of that sort. But I think the vast majority of physicians for sure start out that way. And hopefully more than the majority finish that way, having that perspective. And I'm also curious too, you've had a super interesting career. As you mentioned, you were in a period of history where there was a ton of change in the cardiology space, cardiovascular space. And you had the benefit of not only being on the clinical side, but on the research side. And so you were able to have a foot in both camps, which I think is something that's really interesting, particularly given the time and history we've had. Was, when you look back, I mean, was it really equal? You were, you know, it was equally interesting to be working with patients day in and day out, but then you got to go and explore new innovation? Or was there one that when you got up every day, you sort of looked forward to more than the other?
Yeah, well, that's a wonderful question. And it turned out to be a huge challenge for me, because, you know, I had done this research work, clinical research work back in South Africa, and really never saw myself or had exposure to, you know, sort of more translational slash basic type research. Mm. And that really came with this opportunity to leave South Africa and get this position in Mike Ezekiewicz's animal lab at Yale. Mm-hmm. But once I got there, I was obviously lucky enough that it was in an area of interest, which was, you know, sort of how arteries heal themselves after being ballooned open, a blockage being sort of ballooned open. Mm-hmm. And the literature and the focus on research was exploding in that area, sort of what the field of vascular biology. And so it was exciting to, you know, be part of that. But it was, you know, even more exciting because I was fortunate enough to, you know, get pretty significant grant funding from the NIH to in a systematic way, study some of this. And you know, people were focusing on obviously different aspects of a very complex response to injury. So that was incredibly exciting, but obviously also time-consuming. And I was doing pretty well in that space. And in parallel with that, was doing pretty well in the clinical space as well. And, you know, people more research sort of minded said, well, damn, you know, this is going so well on the research side. Why don't you just cut back your clinical activity and, you know, get another one or two big grants, which you certainly are capable of getting. And so, you know, I had this dilemma. And I have told this story, but I'll tell it again. One day I was just conflicted and I really needed to make a personal decision. And so I took my pager and I gave it to my secretary and I said, listen, unless it's an absolute emergency, I don't want to deal with my pager today. And I sat in my office for a whole day. And I went through this agony of trying to decide, do I want to be a real doc or do I want to be a research doc? And I was, you know, people say, well, how can you do it? I have no idea. Don't ask me. I guess you'd have to ask my parents, who were wonderful people, but not really educated people. But somehow, you know, I had this, I guess, talent, I guess, is a reasonable word, to be able to, you know, sort of be the so-called triple threat, which is clinical, research, and education. But that aside, I made a decision that day, and this was probably in the early to mid-90s, that if I really, really was pushed, I wanted to take care of patients. That had been my training back in South Africa. You know, the predominant training that I'd had was in, you know, superb clinical training. So I made that decision. But I wasn't going to give up on what I was doing. But I wasn't going to, you know, have an 80-20 split. It was going to have to be, you know, 70-70 kind of thing. So that's what I did. And I did it for a long time. And then came the sort of early 2000s, sort of 2003, around that time, where, you know, it was becoming very much more challenging to get grant support. And, you know, as you know, the funding from the NIH fluctuates, and and even on a good day, it's not very robust, and so it's very, very, very competitive. And I just said at that point, I tried an experiment where I had a sort of MD PhD type running my lab, but you know, on reflection, if you very have very high standards for your lab, which you should have, you can also argue that if somebody was really that good, they'd have their own lab. You know what I mean? And I learned that lesson. I learned that lesson. And so I at that point made a decision I was going to focus more on clinical care and clinical research. I wasn't going to give up the research side because I was involved in clinical research at UVA. But an opportunity availed itself at the Christ Hospital in Cincinnati, working with Dean Kyriakos and a whole bunch of other incredibly talented cardiologists. And so in 2007, after almost 20 years at UVA, we moved to Cincinnati, Ohio. And here we are 15 years later. And, you know, it was sort of the latter third of my career. And you know, it was sort of, I guess, somewhat of a midlife crisis in retrospect, but I didn't view it as that. I viewed it as a real opportunity, and I wasn't disappointed. And, you know, I have to thank Dean and many others here for the wonderful support. I will say that my time in academia, and this is another lesson learned, really helped me help my colleagues here organize themselves into more programmatic growth. And I'll get back to that in a minute.
Yeah.
Rather than being an independent contractor. So, you know, a lot of guys in practice are great, but they sort of do everything themselves and they work somewhat independently. You know, those days are sort of past because the complexity of care, you really need a multidisciplinary approach and you need programmatic growth. So, you know, you need to organize people that are really expert in heart failure into a heart failure service. You need people that are very good at imaging into an imaging service, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep.
And so I was instrumental with a lot of help from others in setting up that kind of infrastructure at the Christ Hospital. And when it was necessary to, focus on even areas that were evolving, like valvular heart disease, like severe heart failure requiring, let's say, mechanical support, we had the infrastructure in place to be able to do it. So I'm pretty proud of that. And then came, you know, the other piece, which I was always passionate about and took a huge interest in, and that was really education, teaching people in training to be as good as they could be. And, you know, people would often say I was pretty hard on them, and it wasn't by intent. It was really to, because like anything else, it's human nature to be on cruise control if you're not challenged.
Right, you want to get the best out of them.
You just had to. And I'm very, very proud of all the fellows I trained when I was at UVA, and equally proud of serving, I believe, as a mentor for some of my younger colleagues here in Cincinnati over the last decade plus. So, you know, I mean, all in all, I think I've just been blessed to have a career, as I said to one of my closest buddy yesterday, I said a career that I couldn't have ever scripted or dreamt of. But, you know, it comes with hard work.
Yep.
And it comes with opportunity, and you've got to seize the moment and you've got to make it happen. And, you know, I think having a open mind and realizing that, you know, there's always more to learn is really what this is all about. And ultimately, it doesn't matter whether you teach, whether you do research, whether you take care of patients in a routine way. The end of the day, the question, the first question has always got to be, what is in the best interest of a patient? You know, it's just, we sort of a bit of a me society, as you know, what's right in it for me, but it should be what's in it for the patient as a physician, in my opinion, anyway.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. Hey, as you think back over just the more recent last couple of years, what are some of the changes and some of the, let's just call it, innovations that you're watching that you find particularly interesting? You know, where do you see these things going really in the near term over the next couple of years? What would you anticipate?
Yeah, so I think the one of the big changes in care delivery has been creating a multidisciplinary heart team approach. So it sort of, you know, has been around for a while. It wasn't that formalized. And it would be sort of, you'd get sort of what we call a corridor consult. You know, a guy would be walking by and you'd say, oh, what do you think of this? Well, that's the corridor consult concept is a good one, but it really isn't. It needs to be refined and has been improved. And it started in large part with the treatment of aortic valve stenosis with the transcath aortic valve replacement, or TAVR. And the guys that were really the sort of early pioneers in the field realized that, you know, physicians or interventionalists had to work closely with cardiac surgeons, had to work closely with the docs that were taking care of the patient primarily. Some of the patients had heart failure. So as the heart failure domain became, it really exploded. I mean, it's the biggest area in cardiology today. And then the other big area is imaging. So people that do ultrasound or CT scans. So you really needed a multidisciplinary team to importantly educate one another.
Sure.
To ultimately get a consensus opinion about what was best for an individual patient. And so that, what we call the heart team approach, has now emanated into other areas. You know, people that come in where their blood pressure is very low and they really are sucking wind, so to speak, cardiogenic shock. I mean, they're now shock teams, again, involving a multidisciplinary team. And if you think about it, it really ultimately meets the primary question: how do you best take care of an individual patient?
Right,
so I think this multidisciplinary approach, I think the concept of programmatic growth rather than individual growth, of course, it's important to promote individuals, but it really needs to be done in the context of what's best for the program. And that permeates beyond just physicians, okay? It's physicians, it's nurses, it's nurse practitioners, and everybody else that really is involved in this complex care delivery model today. So I think, to me, that has been probably one of the biggest favorable changes. I think the ability to transition concepts or observations in research into the clinic, so to speak, has been accelerated dramatically. I was just reading something this morning about, you know, the whole concept of mRNA technology, you know, the vaccines that I mean are almost miraculous.
Yep.
I mean, that didn't just happen yesterday. It's been studied for a long time, and people are now on the cusp of using it for novel drug discovery, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that whole field, I mean, the whole concept of personalized care, not just as a concept, which makes a lot of sense, is really evolving pretty rapidly. So, you know, if you have, well, let's say high cholesterol, and somebody says, well, okay, go on to statin therapy, you know, your genetic makeup might say, no, this guy's going to want to shoot you because he's going to have such side effects on it. You know, use something else.
Right.
So being able to do that, being able to predict outcomes of care, and then the whole thing, you know, how do you use predictive models for testing and what have you, you know, artificial intelligence, algorithms, etc. So,
yep.
But at the end of the day, I get back to what to me is the critical piece to all of this, and that is gaining the trust and confidence of a patient when you're sitting across from them in the office, or God forbid, if they're in the hospital. And honestly, we cannot, nor should we, lose sight of it. You know, I will respectfully disagree with some of my esteemed colleagues who think that a stethoscope is a waste of time. Okay, and I will argue with them till they blew in the face rather than me. That I still think a patient wants you to touch them. And there are too many patients that will come and tell you, oh, nobody's ever listened to my heart, when they've got a critical narrowing or leak from a heart valve. So yeah, it's the refinement of testing like ultrasound, you can't compare it, but they complementary. They're not substitutes for one another. So, you know, I think, again, getting back to my original training, which was fundamental clinical excellence, I think you get the most professional satisfaction if you couple that to the ability to use amazing technology,
right,
in the best interest of understanding what's wrong with a patient and then how to go about treating them best.
If you were talking to your 17-year-old self, and as you mentioned, you go straight into training in the South African system, and kids here in the States, they have a little bit longer to figure out what they want to do. But nonetheless, at a young age, if you were talking to somebody who's got their whole career in front of them, and maybe they have an interest in cardiology in general, would there be any things that you reflect back and maybe knowing how the industry has shifted that you would recommend to them to be thinking about?
You know, I've often said the following, and it seems a little crazy in the context of, you know, trying to fast forward to where you ultimately want to end up.
Yeah.
But I am still of the opinion that if you, and I taught this for a long time, I would say to people who want to do cardiology, you know, if you're not a good internist, you know, so general internal medicine.
Yep.
If you're not a good internist, it's going to be hard for you to be a really good cardiologist. if you want to be an interventional cardiologist, you know, put in stents and valves and that. If you're not a good cardiologist, I don't think you're going to be that good an interventional cardiologist or imaging cardiologist or heart failure cardiologist. So I think the fundamentals are important. The question is always, how much time do you spend doing that? Knowing that on the back end, in whatever domain you're in, there's an explosion of knowledge,
right,
and an ever-increasing need to spend time in training. So, you know, if you say to me, is 3 years of internal medicine too long before you do 3 years of cardiology and then 2 years of intervention and or, you know, 2 years of imaging? I don't know. I personally would start at the beginning. I think college is ridiculously long. 4 years to get a bachelor degree only happens in the United States. I'm not aware it happens anywhere else. That should be 3 years with a big cost saving, just as a side issue.
Right.
I don't think you need more than 3 years to get a bachelor degree. Mm-hmm. You know, should there be more creative ways, particularly for people that really are interested in medicine, to maybe do a 2+3 model, you know, where you do 2 years of college and then the 3 years of medical school.
Right.
That kind of thing, maybe. I think there are creative ways, but there needs to be, I don't have the prescription. I think there needs to be discussion about it. But again, I think that, you know, fast forwarding into being an interventional cardiologist without having an understanding of, you know, is the patient sick or not sick? Can you look beyond the heart as you should, as any good doc should? I think the concepts of the timing of how much exposure you have could change a little, but I wouldn't truncate them too much, because otherwise I think you're not going to get the kind of satisfaction that you want to out of being a true medical professional.
It makes sense. As you've retired now and had a little bit of time to get some space in between you, what are some of the things that you're spending your time doing? Are you have any special hobbies, or what's now filling what used to be the triple threat?
Yeah, well, you know, I always was of the opinion that family and profession need to be carefully balanced. And I think along the way, it was a little lopsided at times, not dramatically, but clearly lopsided in the direction of professional commitment and time. So, to be honest, having the ability to spend more time with my family, I have three grandkids. They happen to live in Cincinnati. I never dreamt they would. But, you know, being able to just do something that's simple and might seem like, you know, not a big deal, but occasionally going to fetch them from school is just really nice. Being able to spend more time with my wife, who has supported me through all this for, you know, almost 50 years now, is just wonderful. And then, you know, we have family literally scattered all over, particularly Australia, still some back in South Africa. In addition to that, we like to travel. So having the flexibility, I call it being untethered. So, you know, towards the end of this year, I'm going to Australia for 6 weeks. I mean, so, you know, I can do that. I could never do that before. I've been there many times, max 2 weeks. And, you know, it's not exactly around the corner. So it's nice to be able to travel. And then in terms of, you know, sort of personal growth, I'm still working on it. I still keep up quite a bit with the medical literature because I find it very exciting and interesting. Mm-hmm. I do a fair amount of reading. I'm sort of more of a history reader. I was never, you know, I didn't even go to college. We don't do that stuff. But I like, you know, biographies right now I'm trying to better understand the whole Ukraine thing, reading a book about that. Mm-hmm. People have said to me, well, you know, listen, you've got expertise and you've got, you've obviously got a ton of experience. So, you know, why aren't you seeking out to be like a medical officer, you know, for a startup or what have you? I'm not saying I won't do that, but I'm not, you know, if people come to me, I'll consider it. I'm not rushing out to look for it because I've always been of the opinion sometimes you don't know what you really want.
Sure.
And I don't know what I really want. Am I doing a little bit of consulting? Yes, but not a lot. Could I do more? Yeah, if it suits me, I'll do it. I mean, I'm not trying to sound arrogant here, but I'm not looking to fill my day.
Right. No rush.
So there's no rush. And so I do some volunteer stuff and I could do more. But over the course of the next year or two, I think, you know, this is the sort of time in retirement, I think, where one still hopefully, you're mobile enough and mentally with it enough to sort of explore the world. So, so that's a good focus to have. And that's sort of our focus right now.
I love it. It's a great place to be. Well, Dr. Sternbach, thanks so much for spending time today. What a great background and I think example for so many physicians, younger and older, both. The triple threat. I love that. The education, the research, and the clinical. That's a great term. I'm gonna use that one.
Yeah, it's been used for a long time, and I think there are people that have been blessed and talented enough to do that. But it's not necessarily always the case, and it's becoming a lot more challenging to be able to do all that because, you know, the obligations today are quite different to what they were 20 and 30 years ago. But, you know, just because they're more difficult and more challenging, in my opinion, doesn't mean you shouldn't aspire to do them. You know, if you don't aim high, you shoot low, correct? So and even within one's own domain, I think, trying to set a good example and trying to be better tomorrow than you were today is something that I think is important. And, you know, I think for physicians, I think staying positive and really being thankful for the privilege of what you do, I think can and should inspire one, even in the darkest times, to say, you know what, this is pretty damn unique, what we do as a profession. And, you know, maybe we don't make as much money as the CEO of whatever. I mean, it's not about that, or nor should it ever be about that, in medicine anyway.
Again, well said. And I think what I hear there is if it was easy, it probably wouldn't be worthwhile. All things that are worthwhile require some hard work.
Exactly. And I think that's exactly the point. And so when people say, if you had your time over, would you do what you have done? Without a shadow of doubt. But, you know, you've got to be committed to that. Right. You know, some people, you know, want to be in economics or finance. Great. But, you know, figure out what you want to do. And then you have to aspire to be the best you can. That's what it's about.
Well, thank you, Dr. Sarenbach. This has been a lot of fun. Really appreciate your time and for being involved.
Thank you. Be well.
Thank you.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye-bye.
See you again soon for the next episode of Innovation for Alpha. Make sure to go to Innovation for Alpha for access to prior episode links, show notes, and other valuable resources. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any investment decisions, please consult with a professional. This show is copyrighted by Angel Indie Media, and written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.